raised. I want to look especially at verses 14 and 15 this morning, for the love of Christ controls us, because we have concluded this, that one has died for all, therefore all have died. Why would anyone want to become an elder or a deacon, or a pastor for that matter? It's taking on a lot of responsibilities. It's giving up a number of evenings in the month. It's taking on roles on a Sunday so that you don't really have a Sunday off. You're involved in hard situations. You have to make tough decisions. And you're setting yourself up for criticism. Why would anyone become an elder or a deacon or a pastor? At least pastors are paid for this. But elders and deacons are not. What would motivate someone to take on this calling? Well, there are a number of reasons. And one of those reasons is to get control of people and their lives. The Apostle Peter speaks of this in 1 Peter chapter 5, where he describes some of the possible motives people might have for wanting to become an office bearer. He says in verse 2, "Shepherd the flock of God that is among you, exercising oversight, not under compulsion, but willingly, as God would have you, not for shameful gain, but eagerly, not domineering over those in your charge, but being examples to the flock." You see that? Some might do it because they're forced to. Some might do it because they're paid to. And some might do it just for power. Power in the church. Power over people's lives. Pursuing one's own agenda. Pursuing one's own interests. Getting one's own way. And control, of course, doesn't just happen in the church, does it? It's a tendency in the human heart, where any of us have any roles of responsibility or power, there's a tendency, a temptation to want to use that or abuse that. And it uses sinful means to get its way. Controllers use lies, moodiness, unpredictability, uncertainty, intimidation to get their way in the church, in marriages, in companies, even just in friendships. We can be controllers or we can be controlled by people like that. And the effects of that are pretty devastating, as many counselors will tell you. It tends to cause the victims of control to suffer from chronic stress, a low sense of self-worth, anxiety, fear, and instability. But what counselors and psychologists have also found is that often those who have these controlling tendencies are themselves suffering. They are themselves victims, often victims of insecurity and anxiety, and their controlling attempts are their way of trying to get control of their own anxiety, get control of their own insecurity. It's their attempt to find security through the control of others and their circumstances and situations. And as I've said, maybe not all of us are full-blown controllers. Some are. But most of us have some degree of this in our lives. It's innate to the human heart. So although we're speaking specifically to office bearers in the church, This really applies to all of us that have ministries, who serve, those of us who are married, those of us who have any authority or responsibility in our communities and in companies, businesses, and so on. So I want to ask this morning, if control or the desire to control is not the right motivation, what is? What is the right motivation for Christian service or service of any kind? Well, in 2 Corinthians 5, verses 14 and 15, the Apostle Paul reveals that he was controlled. Not he was a controller. That's an active role. No, he was controlled. That's a passive role. Another power controlled him. As he says here, the love of Christ controls us. The love of Christ controls us. So we want to look, first of all, at what that means, to be controlled by love. We are controlled by love, Paul says. And he says this partly because there were those in the Corinthian church who were questioning his motivation, who were accusing him of having sinful and poor motivations. So he comes, and earlier in the chapter he says, knowing the fear of the Lord, we persuade men. There's one motivation, a godly persuasion, knowing what lies ahead at the judgment and for eternity. He says, knowing this, I'm driven. I'm determined to persuade others. And then here, he gives us a second godly motivation, knowing the love of Christ. He says, this motivates me. So we ask this, what got Paul out of bed in the morning? What got Paul out of bed in the morning? Was it money? Was it popularity? Was it a desire for power? Was it the law, a sense of obligation? Well, I suppose I've got to do this, so I will do it. No. He tells us that as soon as his alarm clock sounded every morning, the love of Christ was where he went. This is what woke him up. This is what got him up. This is what got him going. As soon as that alarm was heard, it's the love of Christ. Let's go. The love of Christ. Let's do. The love of Christ. Let's speak. This is what got him going. When we hear this phrase, though, love of Christ, there's two ways of understanding it. One is our love of Christ. So that's our own feelings and emotions towards Christ. Or Christ's love for us, his people. So what's he speaking of here? Is it my love for Christ gets me going? Or is it Christ's love for me that gets me going? Well, as I'm sure every Christian here will tell you, our love for Christ fluctuates, doesn't it? It goes up and down. So if we were relying on that for our motivation, some mornings we would get up and some mornings we wouldn't. No, what Paul is speaking of here, and the following words make that very clear, is not so much his love for Christ, but Christ's love for him. Because he goes on to speak of how one died for all. We're going to look at that in more detail. So when Paul hears his alarm, he thinks, Christ loves me. Let's go. How does he get to that, though? Does he just lie in bed until a warm, fuzzy feeling comes over him? Until he feels that emotion? Until his own heart begins to pulse with the love of Christ? Is that? No, it's not, actually. That would be wonderful if that happened every day, wouldn't it? But it doesn't. We can't rely on that. Notice his language here. He says the love of Christ controls us because we have concluded this. Now, that word conclusion is not a feeling word. It's a thinking word. It means we have reasoned this. We've used logic to get to this conclusion. In other words, he's bringing truth to his mind. He's thinking on biblical facts. Facts that he goes on to explain to us here. The fact of one died for all. That's what he's thinking on. That's what motivates him. It's very objective, not subjective. Very factual, not so much feeling. So what do we see here? We see sound biblical reasoning with objective biblical events that control Paul. Let's look at that in more detail. It says here, because we have concluded this, that one died for all, therefore all died. We have here a loving death, the love of Christ in his death. One has died for all. Now, when we read that word for, it's a tiny little word, but it's got massive implications. This is not just dying out of sympathy, but dying as a substitute. It's not dying as an example. It's dying in exchange. That's what's going on here. This for speaks of one in place of, one in exchange for. Something happens to him so that it does not happen to the all. And it raises a question, of course, who are the all? On the face of it, you read one died for all, you might think, well, that means Christ died for all people. But we have to remember that the Bible uses all, just as we do, in different ways. Sometimes it uses all to speak of all, everyone, everywhere, in all times. But sometimes it also uses all in terms of all kinds of people. You remember Jesus said, if I be lifted up, I will draw all to me. Now we know not all are drawn to Christ. But rather, it was all kinds, all Jews, all Gentiles, all from different tribes and nations. And that's what fits here as well, because we know that not all people are saved. Not all people go to heaven. That some people, those who do not believe, go to hell. And there's nobody in hell for whom Christ died. Nobody. That would be to undermine and limit the atonement of Christ. So the all for whom Christ died here are all kinds, all ages, all cultures, all colors, all kinds and varieties and types of people. Here is a loving death, and it's underlined for us in the next phrase too. One died for all, therefore all have died. And it's literally, one died for the all, therefore the all have died. The same people for whom he died, we're told here, also have already died. It's looking at the cross really from two angles. It's saying from one angle we can look at it and we can see one dying in the place of for the all. And then you look at it from another angle and you see all dying with the one. What's Paul teaching us here? Again, it's like tiny English words, right? One for all have died. And yet the profound depths of this are unsearchable and immeasurable. What he's telling us here is that the all for whom Christ died, died at the cross. They are reckoned as having died that death of Christ at the cross. If you're here today saying, Christ died for me, add this wonderful truth as well. I died with Christ. When God looks at me, he looks at me and reckons that I have already suffered the penalty for my sins on the cross. Christ died for us, and Christ died as us. Can you see yourself there? Yes, one for all, but also all with one. All dying with the one. That penalty's finished, extinguished, forever. Here we have a loving death. One for all, therefore all have died. But we also have a loving life here. He goes on, and he died for the all, that those who live might no longer live for themselves, but for him who for their sake died and was raised. So he's saying, here are the all who died, the all for whom Christ died, are the all who died with him, and this same all are the all who live for him now. It's the same group in each of these three phases. He dies for the all die with him, and then the all live for him. Same people in each group. And he's saying, if that's true of you, if you've been raised with Christ, if you are also viewed in him and his resurrection, we no longer then live for ourselves, but for him who for their sake died and was raised. To put it very simply, if one died for the all, then the all are for the one. If one died for the all, then the all are for the one. That's how the cross changes our lives and our service. We no longer live self-centered lives, but Christ-centered lives. And you know, if we're not in the all who are living for Christ, we can't conclude that we're in the all who died with him, or in the all for whom he died. So here is a loving death and a loving life available to you today so that you can be amongst the all by faith. Now, why does Paul bring this before us? It's because a controller tries to get control, tries to get peace and security by controlling methods. And what Paul is saying is, we can get peace and security in a completely different way, using completely different methods. Instead of using controlling methods, we use the Calvary method. We use the cross method. As we grasp one for the all, and the all with one, and the all for Christ, as we get controlled by that, as we get influenced by that, as we get motivated by that, that changes what we do, when we do it, why we do it, and how we do it. Changes everything. Paul says here, when I am controlled by Christ's love, I am motivated by Christ's love, this changes us dramatically. So, Paul says, we're controlled by love. How does that then work out in life? It works out like this. We, who are controlled by love, control others. by love. As Calvary controls us, as the gospel gets a hold of us and our hearts, that's how we influence and change and move amongst others. We lead as well. Paul says here, the love of Christ controls us. What he's saying here is the love of Christ changes him. It changes him. He's not controlling by fear, by intimidation, by bribery. No. He's changed by Christ's love so that he doesn't use these methods. He used to use them pre-conversion. That's what he was all about. He was a mega controller. But after conversion, now he's controlled by love and therefore controls by love. In some ways, that's a contradiction in terms, isn't it? Control and love, they kind of don't go together. But what he's saying here, this changes the way we control into a very loving, Christ-centered, cross-motivated method. Christ's love changes us. Christ's love is also current to him. When he says here, the love of Christ controls me, it's in the present tense. He's not saying this is something that happened when I was converted, happened when I was ordained, happened here, there, or wherever. No, he's saying this is a present reality. It's ongoing. It's not something I do on day one and then I move on to other methods. No, he's saying I go to Calvary every day. I go to Calvary to be controlled by Calvary so that changes the way I move and motivate amongst others. This controlling changes him. This controlling is current to him. And therefore, he now serves not for himself, but for Christ. So let's go to Calvary daily, to abandon control daily, to get Calvary methods, not controlling methods, daily. But this word constrain or control, it also speaks of something that's at a person's core. We've got multiple motivations, haven't we? But we've all got one primary motivation, one main driver. Sometimes we're not conscious of it. But Paul is very conscious of it. He's saying at the very core of my being, my number one motivation, number one influence in my life is the cross of Christ. He said if you were to be able to get a probe or a scalpel and you began to cut away the layers of my skin, my muscle, my bones, you're to get to the very core of my being. You know what you would find there? A cross. A cross. He's saying this cross is right at the center, the epicenter, the core of my being. It controls him. It's his main navigating aid. It's central to him. Calvary's Hill was Paul's magnificent obsession. He was absolutely, totally, and completely obsessed with the cross. Let's follow him in that. And then we see here Christ's love channels him. It changes him. It is current to him, it's central to him, and it channels him. The Greek word for control here is the word used to describe a river that's been going along a broad plain, and it's wide and it's slow. But up ahead, there's a gully, a gorge, with two very narrow, high walls. And when that river hits that narrowing, what happens? It speeds up, doesn't it? What was slow and wide is now narrow and rushing through it. He's saying that the cross of Christ for him, as it were, hems him in. It walls him in. It's like a gorge. It's like walls that just keep him incredibly focused and fast in all that he does. Children, I don't know, I'm sure in the summer you always ask your parents, can I get the garden hose? And you get it, don't you? And you start squirting it, and you put your thumb over the end of it to make it go faster and hit maybe more people. So you're kind of controlling, you're constraining, you're putting pressure on the water to change the water as it goes out. And that's the kind of language Paul's using here. He's saying basically, if you take all my energy, all my motivation, all my drive and determination, God has put it into a hose, and on the end of this hose, there's a fitting that has a cross on it, a gap, a cross-shaped gap, so that everything now is channeled through the cross. Everything here is pressured to the highest level by what I think about the cross of Christ. It channels him. This, he says, is true and wonderful gospel motivation. So here is how we are called to lead, called to manage, called to influence. It's by being controlled by the love of Christ so that we control by the love of Christ. We lead then because of love, out of love, and for love. We're controlled by love. We control by love. And controlled by love, we control by love.